Okay, so I think we're ready to start. Can everybody hear me? Yeah? Okay. Okay, so thanks for attending. I know that I'm between you and the party, so I'll try and try not to run over. I'm Daniel Harris from General Motors, and I'm talking today about how we at General Motors manage the SharePoint sites for our user base, which is about 130,000 internal desktop users. And what I'm going to cover is really two parts. It's how do we manage the documents, and really more the sites that contain the documents. And then for the latter half, I'm going to be talking about the records management piece, and really how we layer that on top of our document management strategy. So hopefully you'll get some interesting ideas for your own deployments, and certainly see the way we've done it. In terms of my background, as you can tell, I'm from England. I live in Detroit, and I moved there about 8 years ago to work with General Motors. But prior to that, worked in the UK, and go back all the way to SharePoint 2001, so have a good deal of SharePoint knowledge. And in the time I've been at GM, we've moved from a sort of a departmental deployment of SharePoint 2003, that was part of an engineering package, right the way to the point now where really SharePoint is it for document management. There's really a very small amount of other types of document management tools at GM. So I'll try and illustrate some of that as we go through it. Okay, so really, I thought this kind of brings the point home. What we're trying to do, what we were aiming to do when we set out with our journey with SharePoint, was to try to balance the between governance and control and locking everything down, and making it easy and allowing creativity and flexibility, allowing our users to be able to use SharePoint the way it was intended. So what I'm going to try and emphasize as we go through the session is how we try to find that balance, and how we manage to, hopefully manage to create enough control that we're able to satisfy the ILM team, the Information Lifecycle Management team, but at the same time keep our users really moving and using SharePoint for all the value it brings. So just a little bit of a background on how we use SharePoint at General Motors. The main workloads, as you can see, we use it for search. And when I say that, we have one search center, which is used by everybody in the company. It is one global, we have multiple farms, but it is one global instance of SharePoint. And everybody in the whole of the world, we obviously have pretty much a presence in every country. They all use the North American instance of SharePoint. So this one search center searches all of the SharePoint content. We also crawl a lot of external content. And also our what we call People Finder is also within SharePoint. So we search people as well, people's profiles, which are within SharePoint. As you probably all do, we use it for collaboration and project management. So lots and lots of sites that are used for collaboration around projects or processes, business processes. And we also have publishing sites, departmental intranet sites. We have started recently using SharePoint for dealer collaboration. So that figure of 130,000 internal users doesn't cover the 275,000 dealers that use SharePoint as well. So that's a different problem space. So I mentioned that, but that's really not part of the presentation today. And as I said, we use it. We use document management and records management within SharePoint. We don't use BI very much at the moment. That's probably a workload that we've really only scratched the surface on. But the big number, at least the big number for me, is the 8,500 site collections that we have. And that may seem like a lot of site collections to have. It's across, in our case, across six farms, but they're primarily on one farm. And that's really where we've allowed the users to build those site collections. And again, that's really much of what I'll be showing you today, is how we manage and control that many site collections. And there's some more numbers there. We, in terms of our current status of SharePoint, we're on 2010 primarily, but this year is the year that we're moving to 2013. We already have one 2013 farm that's being used internally, and then that dealer portal that I mentioned, that's all on 2013. We built that last year, so that's where we are with that. So yeah, one of the things I mentioned, obviously, is we've got these 8,500 site collections, and you may say, why so many site collections? And the reason is that one of the principles we adopted very early on was we wanted many small site collections. We didn't want to see these big, great big single site collections. And there's a reason for that. It's really around governance. So the idea is that within SharePoint, you're all probably familiar, a lot of the control points of SharePoint are at the site collection level. So if you're a site collection administrator, you obviously can manage the groups. So if you've got full control, you can manage the groups up at the root level. Features, galleries, things like the quota are all set at that site collection level. So it's very hard to control a very big site collection because it's very hard to track who owns which content, and it's very hard to stop it from growing out of control. And when you're dealing with 130,000 users, you don't know them all. You don't know what they do. So by keeping the site collections relatively small, it's much easier to stop them just ballooning out of control. And instead have lots of separate site collections, but each one can be separately managed. And again, what you'll see when I take you through our registration process, that's really the key to what we've put together. So at the highest level, we have a few basic principles that we try to follow to try and make sure that these site collections, which are being created at about 200 a month, every month, 200 more site collections, to try and make sure that they're well controlled. And in order to create a site collection, the users have to have 30 minutes of training. This is something they do online. But really the emphasis is on learning to control the access permissions of SharePoint. We found that the most important thing, obviously, is we don't want what we call data spills, where information is accidentally shared with the wrong people. And so SharePoint permissions, particularly in 2010, can get very confusing, slightly better in 2013. So that's really the focus of the training, is to teach the person who's going to ask for a site collection how to secure the site correctly. And obviously, when they get the site, it's only available to them, so they have to open up the security themselves. Another principle we follow is that there have to be two owners per site collection. And that's because naturally people leave, people go on vacation, people might walk away from a site and just pretend that they can't hear our cries to renew the site properly. So at least we've got two people to go after who are going to own that site. And that avoids the scenario where the site gets orphaned and nobody knows where the content came from. One of our principles is that we don't, what we call, do passive deletion. So we don't delete content just because nobody wants to own it, because that's a guarantee that we're going to get rid of something we weren't supposed to. So we make sure we've got an owner of the site, and if necessary, we'll escalate it up the management chain to find a manager that will take over from the person who's maybe left. If that happens. In terms of site collections, I mentioned that we like many small site collections. Well, when someone first gets a site collection at GM, it's 500 megabytes. And then we have a process that they can continually request quota increases up to now 25 gigabytes. But that's it. We don't go over 25 gig. Typically, when users start coming to us and asking for more and more quota, it's a sign that they're going down that path of one great big site collection. And normally, once we sit down and understand what they're trying to do, we recommend they go with many small site collections, and that seems to work. So so that's a policy and a process. And I just sort of illustrated that even if your files average 500K, which would be fairly large file sizes as an average, it's still 50,000 items. So that's a lot for one person to feel responsible for. So again, getting back to the governance point of view, you know, we're very keen to make sure that the person who's taking the responsibility for that site collection knows the content that's in the site collection. it's not something that they're relying on a gang of other people to govern and manage for them. We also have a six-month renewal process where if the site is not renewed, the site registration is not renewed, then we actually lock the site, meaning it's locked for read-only. And that generally brings the person in fairly quickly who's going to renew it. And if not, then we go through this process of transferring to a manager to get the site back in control. So that's our way of avoiding this orphan scenario again. So we do have one web app which we identified for large files. You may be familiar with the fact that in SharePoint, the file size limit is set at the web app level. So it's not possible to have different file size limits on different site collections within one web app. So we have one web app which takes up to 1 gigabyte files. And for everything else right now, it's 100 meg. We've just decided in order to get in line with some sort of new direction that we're going to go with 250 meg. We decided that's a big file size for normal scenarios. And today, of the 8,500 site collections we have, we've got roughly 2,000 people who are managing those site collections. So obviously you can work the ratio out. And we have about 20 approvers that approve the site creation process. So that gives you some idea of how we govern at the highest level. So now I'm going to start to show you the system we use to actually create sites. And this is an ASP.NET application that we've written in-house. But again, I'm hoping that you'll get something from it to see what we have and how we built it and how it adds value. So hopefully you can all see this. I know that it might be a little bit small, but I can zoom in if you want me to on certain screens. This is the home screen. And what I'll point out with my cursor here is that we have a number of registration types within this registration system, but the one we're going to focus on today is the SharePoint site request system. And when you come in as a user, what you see first of all is all of your registrations, the ones you've already registered, and which role you play on those registrations and what the status is. So obviously it'll be red if you've got something that's due for renewal that you need to renew. So I'm going to walk you through fairly quickly through the registration process. I won't go over every detail through it, but once we click the registration, we get this blank form. And you can see that we have six steps. The last step is just the final submission, so it's really just five steps that you have to go through as a person who's going to register a site collection. And this system automatically creates the sites. So there's no humans involved. Once the approval takes place, the site gets created automatically. And then everything within the system that manages the life cycle thereafter, again, it all happens automatically back to the right farm. So that's the way the system works. So we ask the users for a description. We do have some different request types, and we try to keep the options very simple, so we keep it down to a team collaboration site or a publishing site. And then there are some what we call advanced requests if they want a project server site or an enterprise. We've got some other different types of sites out there. Further down on that same screen, we do ask them which template they would like. And at the moment, we offer all template types. So we're again, going back to that point about creativity and flexibility, we try to give people as much choice as possible. We even have the no template option so that they can upload their own template after the site's created. And then this was the section where we have the two people, the named users, that have to be assigned to that particular site. So the one's going to be the information owner and the other one's the alternate owner. Okay, on the next screen, we ask them, do they want to enable this site for internet access? And by that, we mean that not VPN, but it's actually registered so that you can get to it from any device on the internet directly. So that's another approval process that would spin off from there. So I won't take you through that one. And then the next screen is to do with search. So one thing, obviously, we want to try and make these sites easy to find, and we want the users to be able to register keywords, best bets, for their sites. But as you probably know, if you're running an enterprise search center, they're set on the search center, and you can't allow your users to just go and do that themselves because they would have too much control. So instead we do it through this interface here, and they just put in keywords, and they can add a number of them, and then they get, again, automatically added into the search center with the code that we've got running. The next screen is, we call it a site map, and this is a map of all of the site collections. As you can see at the top level, we have something like about 20 departments of the company. Some of them are more region-based, and some of them are more process-based. And each one's got an approver. So you have to register your site collection somewhere within a department, and that will decide which approver then approves the site. But what it also provides is a taxonomy of sites. So again, typically, if you create one big site collection, you get that nice breadcrumb trail, and you get that nice structure to the levels of the sites. What we tried to do is recreate that here using this taxonomy tool, so that you can still create a structure of site collections, even though they're all separate site collections. Now, this is probably quite important, is that what we do do is ask the user who's registering the site, bearing in mind there's no content on the site at this point, to tell us what type of content they're planning to put on the site. And again, we try to keep it simple, but we ask them to classify between secret, confidential, and information. And they can come back at any point into the registration and change this, obviously, if the content evolves into more secret from information, then they can come and change that. And once they pick one, in this case, we were going to pick information, then we have this, what we call security label. And the security label, you see it here. You'll also see it when I show you the site collection that gets created. You'll see it's actually labeled on the site collection as well. So this way we can, you know, keep track of what type of content is on which site. And this allows us to drive some additional things. So for example, if the site's a secret site, then we don't allow it to be enabled on the from the internet. You can't get to it from the internet directly. And also, we don't allow people to add groups. So groups can only be added to information and confidential sites. The idea being, why would you have a secret site that's available to a large group? So that's the logic there. Further down, we ask for whether there's any PII, personal identifiable information, that's going to be put on the site, whether there's any Sarbanes-Oxley-based processes or data running on there. And then further down, we have we ask the user to tell us whether they're going to be storing non-business records as well as business records, which gets us a little bit onto the records management topic. What we do further down is we actually list off all of the record series that we have at General Motors. There's about 3,000. And we ask the user to add them onto tell us whether they're going to be on that site. So this keeps a track then of the record types that are going to be on the different sites. And again, one thing I was going to point out is that we're trying to be very open. So we're not saying if you've got Sarbanes-Oxley, then you shouldn't use SharePoint, or if you've got PII, then you shouldn't use SharePoint. We've built the system so that it's capable of storing all of that type of content. We have encryption in transmission, encryption at rest, encryption all over the place, so that the system will work for any classification of content. But it just allows us now to audit the system and to track the site collections and make sure that they're being correctly secured and looked after by the site collection administrators. So finally, we get onto the last step, and this is the one where the user signs their life away. I agree. So terms and conditions, and we give them links to all of the policies, things like the social media policy and the ILM policy, to make sure that they're aware of what they're agreeing to. And that's it. That would create the site at that point. So there's an approval time. I did say there's an approval time as well, but typically I can get through one of those in about 5 minutes. You know, a typical user probably more like 15 minutes. So it's that balance again between not overburdening the user, but at the same time keeping control, keeping a track of the classification of the content, and making sure that a departmental approver has looked at the request, and maybe just sanity checked it, made sure that, you know, somebody isn't asking for a site that already exists or a site that would perhaps be better put on a different system. You know, say it's a process where there's already an IT system specifically for that type of content. And some other features of the solution, which I didn't get time to really show you, but just mention them, is that we have a system for access control review. So one thing we've noticed is that within SharePoint, particularly if you start breaking inheritance, it's very hard to know who has access to the content on the site collection, because you can look at the top, but you can't necessarily iterate all the way down. So we've written some code which goes and collects all the access controls for every single item, and then brings it all up and gives you a flat list so that the administrator is able to see that and review all of the access controls and obviously remediate them if necessary. But the onus is on that site collection administrator to do that once every 6 months, or more often if they choose to, and then to remediate through a review and renewal process. I mentioned the quota increases. That's something else that you can do if you start off with your site and you filled it and you need to get a bigger quota. That again goes through the approvers process. So the departmental approver will look at it and decide, are they going in the right direction or are they going in the wrong direction? And then finally, we have the site deletion process as well, all through that tool. So that will delete the registration and obviously delete the site. And again, we ask the person to attest to make sure that they're doing the right, that this site that they're deleting, all the content is, it's okay to delete. Okay. So, there we are. So just after you've gone through that site creation process, this would be the experience then as a user. You're going to get an email telling you that your site's been created. I should have said, by the way, you might notice there's some odd, strange gaps all over this. This is our legal department. They insisted that I didn't give you any URLs just in case you wanted to come and hack us. So that's what's going on there. So the names have been changed to protect the innocent. So anyway, you would get your email, and it would tell you that the site has been created. You click on the link, and you go to the site. And now you're a site collection administrator. So you have full control. You can go and edit the site with SharePoint Designer. It's extremely open. So we don't stop the users from doing anything to the SharePoint site at that point. What you'll notice up on the top right-hand side is the security label. So this is stapled onto the site collection, and all the branding is as well. Obviously, that's all done through feature stapling. But the users can change it if they wish to. You've got this security label here, and then when you click on the security label, it pops up with this pop-up which shows you who owns the site. So at least you can see who the site collection admins are. You've got their phone number, you've got their email address. So if you do, if you're a user of this site and you see content on the site that you don't think should be there because you know it's a GM information site, then you can contact those owners and ask them, report that the content doesn't seem to be correct, and hopefully they will sort it out. The other place that we really underline it is when you actually go to add content to the site. So if you go to add an item to a list or you go to upload a document, you can see we've added this security label here, which has got some words under it as well explaining what that means about GM information. So no PII, no SOCs, just to really make sure that the user who's about to add the content understands that it must only be GM information. So that pretty much is the way we govern site collections and hence all of our documents. And the challenge that we faced, we've been working on all of that for probably about 7 years. Within probably the last 2 years, we started to give some thought to records management, probably because SharePoint didn't really have a records management offering prior to that. So around the sort of 2010 timeline, I suppose, we really started to think seriously about records management. And the rest of what I'm going to be showing you is what we've built to address records management. But it was really thinking about records management on top of those 8,500 site collections. So we were looking for a very generic solution. We wanted something that could be added to any site collection and that would work for every record type at General Motors. We weren't looking for something that In some cases, I've seen record solutions where they're very distinctly built for one specific business process. What we were trying to do here was build something that would work for any user who's got records on any site collection. So we took on the whole thing. So again, I'm hoping that you'll get something from this, because if you've got a problem where you want to put SharePoint's records management onto your existing site collections, this type of solution may well work for you. So these were kind of what we were thinking of in terms of our goals. You know, we wanted to be generic. We wanted to work with all record types. We wanted to be quick to actually enable on the site collection, and then simple to use. So we thought about scenarios where the user would actually declare a record manually by clicking a button. And we also thought about the scenario where, based on the status of the document, it would just automatically become a record through a workflow. And I'll show you some of these. I haven't got time to show all of it, but I'll show some of these. We wanted it to be flexible so that it would work within place as well as record centers. In general, we prefer to use record centers because, in general, we like the idea that the site collection will get deleted when the project or the initiative is kind of completed. But all of the records have been declared over in the record center, and then they'll be retained for the appropriate period. So we like that model where you keep cycling through site collections, getting rid of old ones, and all of the important content has been declared as records over in the records center. But we do have scenarios where we do use in place as well. And they tend to be where the process really lives inside that site collection, kind of on a cyclical basis. And so the record center really is within that site collection in that situation. What we also wanted to make sure we did was use SharePoint out of the box as much as possible. So obviously making it compatible with the 2013 eDiscovery Center, making it compatible with 2010 Holds. We didn't want to break anything in our design. We wanted to make sure that it continued to work with SharePoint the way it was intended. But we did have some challenges. So our ILM team told us that we had to have clear ownership of every record, meaning we had to have a named owner on every record. And that record owner had to be a current record owner. So if someone leaves, obviously some of these records are retained for 99 years. If someone leaves during that time, then we need to find a new owner. So that was one of the challenges, and I'll show you how we got around that. And then there needed to be a process of looking for non-compliance. So records which are due to be disposed of but haven't been, records which need to be renewed because they're in a state where they need to be given a renewal period, and I'll show you some of that. That was all part of the solution. A few sort of points to explain about how we made life easy for ourselves. We only considered records from SharePoint, so we weren't trying to do records from anywhere else. There's no other source. We have had a few records that have been moved in from other systems, but they're kind of out of the scope of this again. There were no physical records, so we're not dealing with scanning or anything like that. And we did look at third-party tools, but so far we haven't actually used any third-party tools at all. It's all just SharePoint out of the box with a little bit of customization, which I'll take you through. So I thought I'd talk about record management roles. We did some analysis to try and think about who needs to be involved in this process. And obviously, you've got the user and the site collection administrator. They're there already. But we really identified these sort of three new roles, which I've highlighted, which is a record owner. That goes without saying there's going to be someone who's going to own that record. And as I said, they have to be a current owner. They have to still be with the company and still feel that they are responsible for that record. We keep a track of the owner's manager. And that's important because when they leave, we can escalate it up to the manager. If we don't keep a track of the manager when they leave, we don't know who their manager was. So we have to do that. And then we also have a library owner. And the library owner plays a very key role because we group the content together, the record types together within the libraries. And again, I'll show you some of this. I'll actually show you some screenshots of this. But the library owner is the person who's really going to know what that content is. They're going to know what those records are all about. So it's very important to keep a track of who that owner is. And then again, a lot of our escalations go to the owner as well, because they're going to be the person who's probably most able to go and track down the person who should be owning the content. And then, of course, we've got the ILM team and the records administrator, the SharePoint records administrator. And the records administrator, as I take you through some of the screens, I'll just explain who is doing the steps, but the records administrator does quite a few of them. Okay. When we analysed our retention policies, we found that there really were just three types of retention policy. There were about 3,000 different types of record, but they all fall into within three different types of retention. The simple one is you declare it, and then it sticks around for the retention period, and then it expires and can be disposed of. So that's a fairly standard retention type. We found we'd got this extra one, which I'd be interested to know after I've explained this, how many other people have got this type of record. But we've got a record type where the record gets declared, but it remains active. And then after a time determined by the user, they consider it inactive. And then it's when the record's declared inactive that the retention period starts. So it's really like a two-step. So curious, show of hands, has anybody else got that type of record? Yeah. Okay, quite a lot of people. All right, that's good. So you'll see how we tackled that, because that really isn't something that SharePoint out of the box has really got a good way of administering. So that was that's something we spent quite a bit of time on, and I'll show you how we did that. And then the last one was really just based on tax year. So we have a retention type where it doesn't matter when the record was declared; it's all just based on that tax year, and they all get disposed of a certain amount of time after the tax year is closed. So again, they're more like the first one. Actually, it's just a different date that's defined. Of course, it goes without saying, holds block disposal. So all retention policies, it's really just SharePoint out of the box. As long as there's a hold on it, then you can't dispose of the record. And then I attended the last. I don't know if any of you went to the last session on. Records management, very, very large scale. But the guy who's presenting there mentioned that they only use one content type for all records. We didn't. We have a system where a record series, you know, as in a package, if you like, of the metadata, the retention policy, even the grouping, all of that is wrapped up in one content type. So 3,000 record types means 3,000 content types. So that's the way we went about it. And I think the good thing about that is it does really follow the SharePoint model. You know, you don't have to write lots of code then to make the retention policies work. The last thing, just without wanting to confuse too much, but what we came up with is an idea whereby we would have a metadata field for the content type, which is called source, and it tells you where the record came from. So if the record gets declared over to the record center, there's a field called source, which contains the URL of the site collection it came from. If that metadata item is missing off the content type, then the item knows it's an in-place item. So that's the way it works. It's very simple. When you create the content type in the first place, you basically decide, is it going to be an in-place content type or not? If it's in place, then it doesn't have the source metadata field. And if it has the source, then it must be being sent to the record center. So the controls that we've built. This is the features that we enabled as we created our own records ribbon set. And that first button, that declare send button, when you click it, it knows therefore whether the record needs to be sent to the record center or whether it's an in-place record. So that was the way we did that. So all of these buttons we built ourselves. Obviously these aren't SharePoint out of the box, but they kind of look like they are. We thought that was important from a UI point of view. We felt that the send to connections, particularly when you end up with a lot of them, are very confusing for the users to understand. So by just selecting the item and clicking the declare button, it couldn't be any simpler. And as I mentioned as well, we do have the workflow action as well. So we have a custom workflow action that can be used within a designer workflow, which also does the same thing so that the users don't even have to click a button then. So just explain what those other buttons are. You remember I mentioned about the retention type that was based on you have a record that's active, and then you mark it inactive, and then the retention period starts. So we needed those next two buttons. One is to set the inactive date, and the other one is to renew the fact that it's still active. Yes, go ahead. Yeah, I'm going to talk you through that. Yeah, that's to come. Yep. Yep, absolutely. So, I'll take you through exactly how we do that process of sending the record to the right record center. So the next two buttons, anyway, as I said, were for setting the inactive date and the active confirmation. In other words, every 6 months you need to confirm that the record is still active or you're in non-compliance. And then the next two, the last but one is transfer ownership, pretty obvious. That's when someone's wants to transfer the record to another owner. And the last one is dispose. And these buttons are kind of smart. They understand the state of the record. So if the record hasn't reached the end of its retention policy, then clicking dispose records just going to tell you that you can't dispose of the record. Same as if it's on hold and you click dispose, it's not going to let you dispose of it. It's just going to tell you why, though, so at least you understand. So yeah, to answer that question that you asked me. So now if you think about what I explained at the beginning of the session, we were looking at 8,500 site collections. So we've got thousands of site collections. So site collection, collaboration site A is one of 8,500. And of course, there's many, many document libraries within those site collections. And the enterprise content type hub is publishing the 3,000 record types out to everywhere. It's sending it to every record center, it's sending it to every collaboration site. So those 3,000 content types are being pushed out, which is just SharePoint out of the box. So what happens is the user declares the record from the document library using that button I mentioned. And then, if you check out my animation, look at that. So then it goes. Through the routing rules, and I'm going to show you that. I'm going to show you some screenshots of the routing rules. But basically, it goes through what we call the Record Center Hub, which is just a site collection with content organizer rules. And then it gets sent out to another record center. So what you end up with is hundreds of record centers, thousands of site collections, one routing center that sorts out all the spaghetti between where they're coming from and where they're going to. And what that allows us then to do is huge scale, because obviously these record centers can be, I think 4 terabytes is the official recommended limit, but you can scale these pretty big if you want to. Again, what we prefer to do is have many record centers, because we like lots of small site collections where we can. They're easier to back up and restore and keep control of. But we can have many record centers, each with many libraries inside, and we can track, you know, where it's come from, who owns it, and so on. And I didn't say, but we actually have a dedicated web app just for records. So our records are all stored specifically in a web app called Records, which is just for records. And the kind of principles we follow for why we would put something in a different record center or a different record library is by who the audience is going to be. As you're probably familiar, records centers, you don't want to do item level security. At best, you really want to do library level security. You preferably don't want to use folders at all if you can help it, so it's best to have just large libraries. And so think about the security around that library. In general, you want your records to be secured in a slightly more group-based, role-based type way, because obviously the records are going to live on for many, many years. So we really rely on the library, the record library owner. You remember I mentioned that record library owner has a very key role. They're going to be the one who decides on the security for that record library, but it's going to be very, very much audience-based and as inclusive as possible, so that other business people can find those records for years to come. All right, so my next walkthrough, when it animates, is going to be showing you how we go about setting up those routing rules so that the records from one site collection end up in the appropriate record center. And as I said, we use the content organizer. The site collection that we put it in is just in the, it's over on the records web app, and we call it the Record Center Hub, but that's not a Microsoft term, that's just what we call it. And you can see we just have a long list of rules, but they're very, very simple, because all they are, I can show you one here, all they are is we look at the source of where the content came from, So we can say it contains and then a path. So we know it comes from a certain site collection, and then we can decide where it's going to go to, which is that second box. So a destination there. So the mapping is extremely simple and very consistent. Going back to that point, if we want to be able to manage any records from anywhere, with these simple rules, you can then say, well, if it comes from there, then it needs to go there. And of course, we can also, if we want to, pick things off by content type. So you know, we have lots of other filtering capabilities. But generally speaking, our routing is extremely simple. It's really just based on where it's from and where it needs to go to. No, no. So generally, the site's first created, and then sometime after, the users will express an interest in managing records on that particular site collection. And I've got a slide on that as well. But we at that point, we typically consult with them. So it's not that common that the users would try and implement this by themselves. Normally, we have quite a large group of people who manage SharePoint at GM, and we call it the SharePoint Factory. So somebody from the SharePoint Factory would go and work with that particular business group and set this up. But as you'll see, you know, the point is it can be set up quite quickly. One of our a typical assignment, we could probably have a business unit declaring records within 2 weeks. So it's a fairly fast process to get up and running. So the next section I was going to take you through is setting up a library for records management. And if you're familiar with records management already, this should look fairly familiar. The first bit won't be, because these are our custom features. That's that ribbon control that I mentioned. So the first thing that you have to do is activate the ribbon by activating that feature. And then on your document library, you need to state that you want to manage different content types. And then from here, then you're able to go off and pick the content types that you want to add to that library. And often we just pick one and we remove the default, and then that's it. The user only gets one choice. In this particular demo I've provided here, there's a choice of two. They have a choice of a document or a record. But very often, just to keep it really simple, we just give them a choice of one, and then that way they can't get it wrong. But in this case, we're looking at groups. So we have different groups of record types grouped together by business unit. And then once you pick the group, you then get a list of the different records. And you can see we followed a naming convention. It's a good idea. It makes it easier to track things down. But we also use this description text here as well. So it makes it much easier to keep track of all the different records, bearing in mind there's 3,000 of them, and you know, making sure you've got the right one assigned to the right library. But this role, the person who's setting this up, as I said, isn't going to be an end user. This is going to be probably someone in the SharePoint factory or possibly a well-trained power user who's coming in and doing this this work. So the next step here now is would be used, done by the user. So we finally got down to where the user gets involved. And this is like a really simple scenario, obviously. So the user, you know, they've got an empty document library. They go and get their content from there, in this case C drive, making sure that they're following the information security classification. They get offered the standard dialogue where they're given a choice of making it a document or a record. And some users may choose to, you know, treat it in a draft state as a document and then change it to a record type later. In this scenario, it makes more sense for them to, from the outset, say, well, it's going to be this type of record, but at this point it's not a declared record, so it's just sort of set to be that type of record. It's not actually declared, obviously, from the outset. So once they pick that record type, that content type, then they get this dialogue. And this now starts to show you some of the metadata that particular content type has got assigned to it. And you'll see, if you're keen-eyed, that at the bottom there we have ILM source. So you can see this one's going to be a send to record. This one's going to go over to the record center. Because SharePoint doesn't allow us to hide that field, as you can see, it says do not fill in. It doesn't matter if they do, we just overwrite it anyway. So. Okay, so they fill in the mandatory metadata, and again, we try very hard not to overburden them with metadata. We do use managed metadata where appropriate. So you can see this information security classification has got the managed metadata symbol by it. But a lot of these things are just dates, obviously, that'll get filled in as we go along. So now the user's got the item in the library. And at some point further on, probably after they've discussed it with their colleagues and edited it for a while, it needs to be made a record. So at that point, all they do is select the item, and then they click that declare record button. And when they do that, they get this dialog, which says success. That's always a good sign. And gives them a URL for where the record got sent to. So obviously that's the record over in the record center. We consider this a bug, by the way, so we're going to get rid of that. But the inactive date is no longer relevant at that point. But anyway, so the record, it's been sent over to the record center. And we leave behind a smart shortcut, a shortcut for the record. So the record's not disappeared. It still looks like it's there. The users can get to it by clicking on it. But like I said, the idea is this site collection, maybe within 2 years' time, 3 years' time, it only contains non-business records, and therefore our policy is 3 years for those. So if they've been there for 3 years and the system, effectively the site, is no longer needed, then you dispose of the site, and then that way all the records are still sitting over in the record center. And they may be there for, like I said, 99 years or 7 years or whatever the policy is. So now if we click that link, we go over to the record center, and we can now see the record sitting there within the record library. And you can see the record type that's assigned to it, the content type that's assigned to it. And yes is the answer. I had to think about that one. Yes. So we use all of our record centres have the SharePoint auditing enabled, full auditing. So we keep a track of every event that occurs in that record centre. We actually use another tool. We do use a third-party tool for auditing the SharePoint events. And we use them on all of our secret sites as well as on the record centres. The question was, do we keep track of changes on the records? And using again SharePoint out of the box with the auditing enabled, then it keeps track of any changes that are made. So who made the change and what change happened to that metadata? So yeah, it's all there. We use semantic DLP, data loss prevention, and really that just comes and ingests the SharePoint audit logs and then puts them into more like a warehouse. It's not especially useful for this particular scenario, but naturally if we had somebody come and start downloading lots of records, it would spot that type of event, and then it would alert us to the fact that someone's just downloading all the records. So we'd be able to quickly take action. So that's really the purpose of that tool. Okay, so we've selected the record, and what we're going to do now is set the inactive date. And that was that button, the set inactive date button. So this record type is one of those that needs to be actively renewed when it's active, and then you set the inactive date. So you can see now why we've got that button for setting the inactive date. So we set the date and click OK, and then we get that message that was successful. So finally, normally it'll be at least 3 years, probably 7 years later, after we've managed that record carefully, making sure that the owner stays current. The owner's going to get an email telling them, once a week the emails go out by a job that runs, and it'll spot that the record is now due for disposal. So the user's going to get an email telling them they have a series of records that need to be disposed. Each one's got a link, so the users can come in now. They can select that particular record, and then they can click dispose. And then they're going to get this acknowledgement that the record, they have to acknowledge that it's okay to delete that record, and they click OK, and then that would dispose of the record. So it's gone at that point. So basically, that's really the whole life cycle now. We've covered from when the record is first created right the way through to when it was disposed of.
So, mm-hmm. They say that not to dispose of it, then what state does it go in?
Yeah, so if the question was, what if that record, the user doesn't want to dispose of it, it's not ready to be disposed of? And the answer is at that point that they would need to assign a different record type to that record series, or change the record series to that particular record. So they need to meet the ILM team and understand why that particular record shouldn't be disposed of. But basically, it really means that they've set their requirements up incorrectly. They've either made the inactive date too soon, or they've just picked a content type that's inappropriate for that particular content. But yeah, we went through, and I didn't put it in this deck, but we did go through all of those scenarios of what happens when a record series gets split into two, which does happen. What happens when two record series gets merged back into one? What happens when something's been misclassified, which would be that one, and you have to give it a different record type? So each of those things, really just SharePoint out of the box, you can reassign a content type to an existing existing record. You can just give it a different content type. Typically, you'd need the library owner to do it. So the library owner has full control. We trust the library owner. We work on the principle that if someone's going to be fraudulent, they're not going to get the library owner to agree to it. So we kind of work on that basis that it takes two people to be fraudulent. Yep, so the question was, what's the architecture of the record centers? How do we group them together? And it is divisional, it is more divisional, but it's not quite that, it's not one-to-one. So really what we do is when we, particularly when we look at the record series, we look at the volume of content, and also whether they kind of fall under maybe yearly categories. So what we're trying to do really is try to keep the record center to a manageable size. But we don't have any problem with, we've got hundreds of record centers. So we don't have a problem with lots of record centers. We're more concerned about making sure that they're manageable. So what that typically means, in fact, if I just go quickly back, you could see there, I'll just highlight it for you. So this is a North American quality department. And each one down there you can see are the different assembly plants. So this was General Motors cars. So these are the assembly plants, and each one of those is a library. So this one particularly is a quality process. There's a library for each assembly plant, and then the records from that assembly plant, just for that one quality process, go into those libraries. And that would be that record center. It might be used possibly for some other similar type of records that are for sort of quality for those particular plants, but we wouldn't have any problem in creating that structure again, another record center for something else that was related. The main thing is we want to make sure that the audience is not mixed, because obviously the security on those libraries needs to be set at the library level. So those are really the considerations that lead you to those design decisions. But the system's very flexible, and you can change your mind. You can always reroute the records back to somewhere else if you want to. You just have to think about what the consequences of that would be. Okay. So I'd mention the ongoing monitoring rules that we have. And this is a job that we have that runs on the web applications. It runs out of hours once a week. And what it does is it goes through all of the record centers. It actually goes through all of the in-place sites as well, where the in-place records are. So what it does is it first of all detects whether the records management features are on the site collection, and if they are, then it goes down and iterates through the whole site collection. And it looks for records that are due for disposal, records which need an inactive review. It also looks at all of the owners of the records, and then it goes off against the identity management system and finds out whether that user is still active. So if a record has become orphaned because the owner's no longer at the company, then it picks that up very quickly within a week, and then escalates that up. And what it does is it runs, sends emails out to the appropriate person. Obviously, for the first two of those, it would send it to the record owner. It does that for 4 weeks, and then if we don't get a response back, then it starts escalating to management and the library owner. to try and track somebody down to sort that out. So it's very kind of active to make sure that we don't have content that's become orphaned or not being properly controlled. And of all of that data that we capture, we put into a SQL database, which is our own SQL database. You know, it's not part of SharePoint. So we can run reports on it and we can, you know, do analysis. Yeah, so the question was, if we have a site collection that no one's renewed, how do we deal with it if it's got records on it? And the answer is that, if you remember, I said we don't do any passive deletion. So no site ever gets deleted just because nobody owned up to it. We will always find somebody who's an owner. So normally, it's just a management chain. It'll escalate up through the management chain till somebody owns the site. And then they'll need to go in there and look for records. If the site's going to get deleted, they're going to have to do it through that deletion, through the site registration system that I mentioned, and they're going to have to, you know, sign on pain of death that the site doesn't have records and that they are authorised to dispose of the whole site. So typically, if they did come across that, say it was we'd had somebody who'd been very very bad at managing records and then left, and somebody else picked it up. The scenario would be that they would go into the libraries, they would go and find the records that that are in there and declare them over to the records centre, and then they could dispose of the site collection. So that would be the process, is they would have to go in and select records, declare them, and then they could get rid of the site collection. So I briefly touched on this earlier, but the implementation and training kind of system that we use is really around consultation, working with the business team on the overall process. A lot of the time when we come across a records management problem, it's not just a records management problem. There's normally some other business process that gets the file to the point that it's ready to be a business record. So typically, we end up consulting on the whole business process, not just the last bit, which is getting it into a record format. And as you've seen, it's pretty easy to set up. I mean, what I showed you today, probably a lot of you could go and do it now. So you're trained for the SharePoint factory. But most of what we do anyway are the more complex solutions, which are around the other aspects to driving that business process to get it into a record format. But again, going back to that point about governance and creativity, what we're really trying to do is focus on the ease of use, making it so it's just that one-step declare, or even if through the workflow action, a kind of a no-step declare, and that the users feel like they're just taking part in that business process, not that they're having to think hard about records management. So really the goal was to make sure that they don't have to make decisions in the process. The process is very straightforward for them. I mean, they probably have to decide when to declare, but other than that, they don't have to decide which content type it is or what metadata they have to fill out or anything like that. It should flow fairly naturally. So my what's next slide is talking about what we're going to do next, apart from go to the party. What are we going to do next at GM around records management? And one point that we're still fairly not that heavy on at the moment is this idea that if you haven't declared it, then you need to dispose of it, you know, within a reasonable period of time. So we still have a lot of content which has neither been declared as a record but is over 3 years old. So therefore, technically, it's in a non-compliant state. And one thing we want to try and drive is making sure people are actually declaring records as records and not just leaving them sitting in site collections. So our ideas around that, you saw the registration system that every 6 months they have to come in and attest that they don't have any records in there and that they're all being managed by the correct ILM process. Obviously, they're not telling the truth. So what we plan to do is start to find out that they have content that's over a certain age, in our case 3 years, and present that back to them at that point, effectively asking them to, challenging them to explain why they've got content which is over 3 years old that hasn't been declared as a record yet. Yep. Through that site registration system. So every 6 months they come in anyway and say, I attest that this is correct. And like I say, they're not necessarily telling the truth because we know the content's more than 3 years old, so it can't be true. So what we'll by we can either not allow them to renew the site. So we could say, well, your site's locked until you've decided what you're going to do with that content, which would be heavy-handed, or just do it through a more kind of gentle persuasion approach, which will be to just to surface it, just to make them aware that they have actually got content which really is non-compliant. And then obviously that'll drive them to come to us to help them build a records management solution for that site collection so that they'll be able to get the content off into the record centres to make it compliant. Yeah, so the question was, how do we manage site access? We don't manage it through the site registration system. The actual site access is managed by that site collection administrator, specifically on that site collection. But what we do is we get the access control list that they've set on the site and pull that back into site registration. So we can see patterns. You know, again, if you've got a secret site, we can see how many people have got access to the secret site, and obviously alarm bells ring if there's a lot of people having access to a secret site, for example. So other things that we're in the process of doing, as I mentioned, we're upgrading to 2013. One of the reasons for that was the e-discovery capabilities, and particularly integrating the e-discovery solution with Exchange. So you know, that's kind of really everything I've shown you is fully functional and fully interoperable with the 2013 e-discovery solution. So we're looking forward to getting that working. We are looking at some more enhanced auditing technologies as well, around the type of topics I've already told you about, you know, just spotting things which are non-compliant and being able to address those. In particular, we're always keen to try to work out who has access to a site, who accessed the site, who actually did access the site, and then close that gap so that, you know, you don't have these lots of data that's not being used by anybody but's widely available. We're looking at a hold management solution as well. That so for those of you familiar with the 2013 eDiscovery Center, it puts a hold on the site collections, but it's invisible to the site collection people, owners. It just puts a secret library in the site collection, and then as people edit the data on that site collection, it puts the original into the secret library. So it works perfectly, but we have a scenario where we want the users to be able to tell us that particular piece of content needs to be put on hold. And the 2010 system works well with that. The 2010 holds work well that way. But the problem is the 2010 holds are site collection specific. So we're coming up with a way that we can publish a hold to multiple site collections and then allow the users to elect to put the content on hold within their site collection. So that's something else we're working on. All right, and that concludes my presentation. So I know we've had, thank you. So I know we've had some questions along the way. Are there any? Yep. If you want to ask in the mic, then everyone else can hear. So me repeating it. Yes. The question was disaster recovery. When I mentioned we had over 500 servers, I should have said we have a full DR environment that's scaled to the same as production, and then we also have a pre-prod and a pre-prod DR for practicing the DR. So we have. We have a full DR site that's you know, obviously geographically separated. We used the SQL mirroring or log shipping technologies because always on isn't fully supported yet. But that's the way we do DR. Yep.
Question: you said you had, I think, 3,000 content types in these record series, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. So how do you get, or how do you train your users to pick the right ones?
Yeah, so the end user never needs to know any of that. When the when the document library is set up for that user, then really there's typically just one record for that particular document library. There might be two or three, but that's all. So it's all done so that the users never see that those 3,000.
But your site owners, your 2,000 site owners need to be knowledgeable enough to pick from your list of 3,000?
Well, so generally speaking, when we do the implementation, it's done really by someone who's knowledgeable on records management, because it is too much for the average site collection administrator to know anything about. Right. If they ever do just happen to browse, and we've had a few sort of curious site collection admins look in the gallery and they've seen all these records, obviously they could start to pick a few and then they could start to declare things over to the record center. But typically, because the routing rules aren't there, they get sent up in the drop-off library. And then what we do is we can see who did it, and we go to them and say, what are you doing? And then we work with them to set it up properly. So that's what happens.
So we're really moving down the whole path of trying to do limitation of data life anyway, just from a e-discovery perspective. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what is GM doing in terms of personal documents, the things that aren't on SharePoint, the things that are on local disk or right. my personal folder yep. or my sites? Are you working on default information management policies to turn everything into like an in-process, and at the end of in-process it has to be declared as a record or it's disposed of?
So I wouldn't say we're quite that far forward. What we're doing is we're encouraging everything really to move to SharePoint. That's really our strategy. So we're pushing the OneDrive for Business. That's going to be part of our 2013 rollout. You know, we're going, I didn't want to get into all that in this deck, but I'll tell you all the stats. So obviously we've got 120,000 or 130,000 users. We're going to give them 25 gigabytes each. This is all on-prem. So it comes to about half a petabyte of data that we're going to manage. And it's going to allow them to store the documents on their C drive in the cloud or in our internal cloud. And that will make them discoverable through e-discovery. But what we're planning to do is go down the path of saying that's for non-business records. If you've got business records, they should be on a collaboration or a team site, and then there should be a process for managing them. So it should be that they're non-business records. The policy we manage right now for email is very aggressive. Once the emails get more than 6 months old, if you haven't identified them as business records, they'll get flushed automatically.
We're going down the same path. The challenge, of course, is that even though from the user perspective it's not a business record, mm-hmm. it's still discoverable. Because mm-hmm. everything is discoverable.
Oh, yeah,
we're trying to limit
it's all discoverable.
That.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. So our e-discovery team, they've got the full capability of searching all of this content and discovering it. But yeah, it's really just a matter of driving the users to do the right things. We do an annual training that everybody in the company has to take on ILM. And what we're trying to do is partner with the ILM team so that more and more and more they can use the system to enforce their process, rather than the process is just a documented process and there's no tools to help you do the process. Yeah.
I was just going to ask, from kind of end to end, you mentioned the ILM team, but as far as consulting with the business and running that whole solution, roughly how big is that from a staff perspective?
Staffing, yeah. The people who've really worked on the records management piece, like as their permanent job, is really probably just three people. So that part's been, that's from the SharePoint point of view. The ILM staff, I think, is probably only about four people.
Okay, so three on the IT small side, numbers. Or is that different? Because I saw the 500 servers, so I was also...
That's right, yeah, so SharePoint overall at General Motors is, there's 75 people in the innovation team that work on new projects, and then I think there's probably like 10 people in operations. So yeah, 95 people overall, but just specifically on records, just a couple of people, you know.
Okay, thank
yeah.
you.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. Custom or third-party tools to manage the retention policies as well as e-discovery, just in case?
No. Everything, we're just using SharePoint out of the box for everything. Yeah.
Cool. I did have one more.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry.
You talked about, because this is going back to how you manage the retirement of sites. Just because a site is 3 years old and it didn't have records in it doesn't mean that the content that's there is 3 years old. They might have deleted old content.
That's
so
right.
Are you scanning the sites to see if there's content that's older than 3 years?
Yeah, we haven't done it yet, but that's where we want to go, is that we'll actually look at the content, the individual documents. We'll look at their created and modified, and then we'll basically present that back to the user, and then they're going to have to make a decision about whether that should have been a record. But again, what we'll do is drive auditing behaviors. So, you know, like with anything, you'll have certain sites that'll spring out as being clearly non-compliant, and then somebody or a human will go in and meet that individual and say, what's going on? Why is this working the way it is?
How many people do you have dedicated just to being record librarians across?
Yeah, so pretty much every library. I mean, there's some people take a role of managing multiple libraries, but they're the people in the business then. So they're not. That's not their day job. They will do other things as well as managing that library, but typically they're the owner of that business process. So they're business people who have just been trained.
So thousands.
So thousands, exactly. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, that was impressive. how long did it take you to implement like the whole life cycle of site creation and the records management pieces?
The original .NET code that we wrote probably took us about 6 months to get written. At the time, we had a consultancy write it for us. Myself and a couple of other people kind of did all the screens and worked it all out how we wanted it to work, and then we had a consultancy build it. Since then, we've had a full-time development team, literally since then, so 7 years. We've had a full-time development team working on that tool, but a lot of what they're focused on is those other registrations. So we, for example, register, it's like the Bill of IT. All of the applications in GM are all registered in that tool as well. All of the websites are registered in there as well. So there's a lot of other registrations. We've got like a short link registration, you know, for like a tiny URL, all that type of stuff. It's all in there. So, but they, so I'd say it was probably 6 months really was what the time was taken.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.